Good evening. Good evening and welcome to the Arnold Freeney Gallery for another one in their Art in the City lecture series. My name's Gordon Dalton. For my sins, I'm an artist, curator. I also work at the Glenvivian Museum and Art Gallery in Swansea. Quick introductions we've got tonight. Very pleased to have Adam Sutherland from Grisdale Arts up in the Lake District. And also very pleased that you could join us again in Bristol, the artist Olaf Bruning. The last time three people were on this stage or within this building was last week, where I believe Nick Clegg, David Cameron and Gordon Brown did their thing, and so we're going to try and do our thing, but I'm going to try and not try and influence you for tomorrow, although I hope you're all voting. But there'll be nothing in the talk other than the opportunity for me to promote myself. And this is my work as an artist, or part of my work. I only included this because this is at Grisdale, where some of you all know artists can go and make work and mess about and meet each other and do new ideas. So I thought, you know, take the opportunity to promote myself. So there'll be nothing else to do with politics. Looking very happy with himself there, and not so much there, although you never know. This is another piece of my work, never mind this artist from New York. Kind of included this because it kind of it's a couple of things that I'm interested in making work where you put one or two things, if you put one thing next to another, it makes another thing. And a couple of those things are very predetermined decisions in my work sometimes, and sometimes they're completely random to the point where I'm asking other people to suggest a colour or suggest a material or and somehow kind of just put one thing next to another and you get another thing, or there's a different way of seeing things. And that's kind of what I'm interested in a lot in Olaf's work, and we'll come into that later. In the top corner there is a picture of Victoria Beckham, who's wearing, I believe, is it Issey Miyake dress, a Marc Jacobs hat, and photographs by Jürgen Teller, and the advert was from Frieze magazine, which is probably the best example of overindulgence that you could have. David Cameron has suddenly popped up, appearing as Nicolas Cage in Wild at Heart, and looking again his usual self, but no more politics. Some more pieces of my work. Again, one thing added to another, we've got a monkey or a gorilla hanging, which another thing that I'm interested in, which kind of relates again to Olaf, is kind of like odd little things or odd little anecdotes that you kind of come across that can kind of keep with you and they'll stick in the back of your throat, or there might just be something that you've forgotten about for ages, but somehow in our memory banks they get lodged. Things get lodged in the back of your mind, and that can be purely visual, it can be something you've read, spending too much time on the internet, as we all do. Walking down the street or getting the train today, I spent the train over from Cardiff today, looking to the back of hedgerows as we came into Bristol to see if we could see any kind of bin bags full of dead bodies. Does no one else do that? Basically, the monkey is kind of, this is the good people of Hartlepool. During the Napoleonic Wars, a monkey got washed ashore dressed in a little French outfit. And the good people of Hartlepool thought it was a French spy. And because the monkey tried to defend itself speaking in monkey language, they believed he was speaking French. So they hung the monkey. They tried it went to jury, and they hung the monkey. And so people from Hartlepool are generally considered to be monkey hangers, which is kind of where this comes from, but the story is kind of something that's always kind of in the back of my head, and kind of those kind of, again, those with the first one, kind of things that are put together, maybe shouldn't be together and make something else, but then some kind of cultural miscues that kind of overlap and kind of get bred into something else, not so much as a straight narrative, but as something that, or as a kind of, even as a memory, just something that you interpret as something from where you're from, but someone from a different part of the world or a different culture, especially, I guess, with Olaf's work, we'll probably talk about it later, kind of like if somebody, especially in the films that we're going to see, where someone from a Western mindset could go into an Eastern and vice versa, and there'd be a completely different set of miscues going on in their head. Nick Clegg. Looking very dapper in both pictures. And just for a fair balance, there are other parties, such as the Green Party and the BNP. As I said, I kind of work as an artist and as a curator, and have a small agency where I represent artists on a very small scale, but we do other projects as well. And it's Mermaid and Monster kind of acts as an umbrella for a lot of my other activities outside of being an artist. So whether that's representing artists at art fairs or kind of any of the consultancy work I do, or whether that kind of is working with architects or working with different councils on public art projects, which I've luckily been very lucky to have been working with Bristol City Council on this project. A couple of other public art projects that I've worked on, which kind of things that I'm kind of very proud of. This is in Cardiff. This is Joanne Tatham and Thomas Sullivan. And this is about 16 metres high. And it's a MDF pyramid. To the back of this is a new, a Wimpy estate. The other side is the Cardiff Opera House, the Millennium Centre. That has been built roughly around the time. And this is on an old scrap of land. There's a school behind it. And interesting that even though this was a temporary project, it was only supposed to be there for 2 days. Instead of people, those local hoodies that everyone was scared of, the kids actually, this is hollow. You can actually get inside of this. And they took, that became part of their community. And that kind of relates again to one of the reasons I was interested in working with Olaf. And that these strange things that we call contemporary art, we can put them into very public places and places that you wouldn't normally expect to see something of, you know, quite a challenging aesthetic nature. But meanwhile, the Wimpy estate to the right of this got burnt down by the kids, and they didn't burn this down. Michael Jackson and E.T., if only E.T. was standing tomorrow, or Michael Jackson, showing there's no difference if you're black or white. Another couple of projects further down of my projects. The artist on the top is Marietta Kapotric from Slovenia. This is a sustainable house. Inside of this top building is a bedroom, a toilet. You could live in this, and the walls are actually made of vegetables. Person was planned that they would sell their wares that they are growing, which didn't please again to the right of this was a Tesco Express, and they were not very happy that they were being undercut. And Veronica Valk is an Estonian architect, and she built an inflatable hotel within an old NatWest Bank in Cardiff. And all of this, all the walls, it fills like an old bank. And it's powered by a desk fan, which I didn't think would work. No one from the commission agency thought it would work. I'm not even quite sure if the artists think it would work, but it did work. Close Encounters of the Third Kind, possibly my favourite piece of artwork, is this bottom slide with Richard Dreyfuss constructing the mountain, or possibly the best one is where he makes it out of mashed potato. This isn't a party political poster. This is by the artist Kendall Gears, a South African artist who did a poster project in Cardiff. Some more politicians. St. Paul's Park in Bristol, so we're kind of at the beginning now. I was invited or proposed to Bristol City Council to come up with some ideas for this park, which was incredibly brilliant. Really thankful for the opportunity to do that. I'd lived maybe 10 minutes. There's an exit here, there's an exit probably here, exit there, but I don't think I'd ever walked through this park. It's been kind of regenerated. This is a deconsecrated cemetery where all this grass is. which the graves are only probably about six foot beneath the grass, if that, in different parts probably only like 2 or 3 feet beneath the grass. Obviously you've got the church, which has been deconsecrated, which now is the home to Circa Media, which the people from Bristol know as a circus group. And within this patch of grass here, which is a lot wider than what you can see here, are a trapeze where they come to practice outside. On top of that, obviously, you've got the St. Paul's community, which is, people from here know, is very vibrant, but not without its problems. But this park is kind of, in terms of opening access to the park, it was felt that even though it's been landscaped and the, you know, it's a very nice landscape and going down the seating, obviously you've got a children's playground in there, which kind of contrasts, I think, quite nicely with the church. And even though the circus is in there, you've got quite a nice little context for putting work into. But you've got to be very sensitive about, obviously, the community that lives around there. But mainly it was kind of, the park wasn't being used as a kind of family place. And just to try and get people to cross it, but kind of retaining some kind of sensitivity to the park, you didn't want to, I couldn't go in there and put a 16-metre black pyramid in there. I couldn't, there's various things you could do, I could do, and we looked at those. But kind of in this playground, I'd come through past the church, and this was one of the first things I've seen in there. And I mean, for those that know Olaf's work, this just kind of reminded me of Olaf, basically. It doesn't look well, no, maybe it does, but it's kind of, in terms of kind of how he kind of works and that you can spot things or things can get picked up, and they're not, there's not an overarching approach to it. It was done, or I'd approached it, and the artist I was speaking to was out of genuine curiosity, or almost a disinterested curiosity about how you can spot things and kind of how they turn into something that another thing that will lodge in the back of your mind, or you may kind of come across them again, or you may pass that on to somebody else, which can be a very subtle thing, or it can be a very kind of over-the-top thing. And in talking with Alder Rinaldi, who's the Senior Public Art Officer for Bristol City Council, and Ollie Roberts, and the St. Paul's stakeholders, who were very, very generous with their time and ideas. I think it was Ollie who'd kind of said they'd done some work with children's groups in the park about what they'd like to see in the park, other than a playground. And so that was the first thing I kind of picked up on in some of the meetings that we were having. And Ollie had said something really interesting, said there was a kid, or a bunch of kids, that said that all they wanted in the park was a giant cat that had lasers for eyes, which was probably the best proposal for a piece of public art I'd ever come across. It wasn't as a sculpture, but I knew that this had existed just from, I'm not sure what Olaf thinks about this piece of work.
By the way, this piece should be destroyed. That's my worst piece ever, and I'm not very proud of it.
Basically, this got Olaf the gig, so you better not put it down too much. But so I kind of showed this to Ollie, and we kind of laughed about it, and it kind of very quickly, Olaf became somebody that we were all very interested in working with. His works in previous kind of very well known for his kind of some of his photo works or grouped works, sometimes referred to them. So you've got Mr. Hand, Mr. Knee, and Mr. Foot, maybe. And obviously, because I was looking for an artist who was quite sensitive with the deconsecrated cemetery in the church, I kind of obviously knew of Olaf's work previously. And it's a little story, but kind of the first time I'd seen Olaf's work, I think it was in Liverpool, Biennale 98, 2000, I can't remember, but I'd walked into this hole, the Blue Coat Gallery in Liverpool, had a hole knocked through this wall, which kind of looked like a library, and inside was like strobe lights and soil on the floor, and I think probably this casket with this doll, which is the world's most lifelike sex doll, was sat in the coffin with an axe by her side. And I saw that about 9 o'clock in the morning and came out saying it's the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. But by the end of the day, I think I told about 200 people about it, and we all went back and saw it again. So I kind of had that idea again of kind of recurring images and things come back to you. wherever you get them from, whether it be from movies or again the internet or from reading books, this idea that something can kind of stick in the back of your throat. Olaf had come to the UK again to do a commission over in Cardiff, and this very good looking chap in the middle in the blue t-shirt, that's me. And one of the other people is the senior public art officer for Bristol. I'll leave you to work out which one that is. But so again, Olaf is working these kind of group photographs, but doing installations as well. I wasn't that aware. I mean, I knew they existed, but I wasn't that aware when I was kind of talking to the council about kind of Olaf's sculpture work. I knew there was kind of smaller things, very kind of, again, that idea of sticking one thing together to make something else, kind of quite lo-fi, like made things, bought objects that were just stuck together or kind of or just had eyes stuck on it, like the bin. One of the installations, this is kind of a very early installation, kind of apes. Again, the group photographs, kind of that's more aware of, but I had this image in my head of these, of Easter Island, where Olaf, as part of kind of his continuous travels around the world, kind of flown, managed to get through all the bureaucracy, managed to get to Easter Island, try and get permission to do some work with the statues, and got all the way there and just put bunny rabbit ears on top of them, which I thought was completely frivolous and over the top, but absolutely perfect for what it was. Around this time, I'd done a couple of talks with Olaf at the Chisenhill Gallery, I believe, and so this is kind of what I was thinking about showing to the council and kind of what we could do, that these would kind of, these animals or these creatures could appear around the park, but obviously it's a public park, these are wood and handmade candles, which, you know, easily destroyed, there was that to bear in mind. And so that kind of idea of commissioning a permanent piece of work, it's difficult as an artist, because in terms of, well, contemporary artists, I don't know how anybody else feels, but you kind of think of as permanent as maybe the next show or the show after, or possibly a couple of years, or if somebody buys it, yeah, maybe 5 years. I guess an architect would even think of permanent being 15 years at max, or maybe 20 years. But in the brief, it was that this work for the St. Paul's Park had to be 25 years, which, when I read it, you know, it was quite a challenge. And when I told Olaf, it was, again, another challenge. But that was what led us on to almost wanting to do something. So it was kind of looking at different pieces of work that could take that on. So I was aware of this work, which Adam, I think Adam was involved in this through Grisdale, which is, these are coffins, handmade coffins from workmen in Ghana, which Olaf had commissioned. So you've got a lollipop, a snowman, and a bar of chocolate. Is it a bar of chocolate? Yeah,
I'm talking about chocolate.
And it's thinking of these things as standing in the park. But bear in mind, they already had quite a garish looking children's playground, which I think it was Heritage, kind of the umming and ahhing about that. So we kind of want to be more sensitive to the actual situation we were in. So it's kind of, I didn't think these would actually add anything more than the guy, the bin with the eyes on it. Would these be any different? Or I would love to have done them, but I don't know if it would have fitted. So all those considerations coming into play. I was aware of this much earlier work, thinking like ghosts, the cemetery, the church, maybe a bit too gory for a children's kind of play area. And Olaf showed me these works, again, kind of looking at something more permanent here. So kind of the ideas were all coming together. This time we're talking, to like St. Paul's people, we were doing the various little chats, going to meet different groups. Another piece, this is in Miami, I mean obviously not temporary, but built out of sand, in tradition of when you go on holiday you see people making those, well, pretty well made sand sculptures. And then out of the blue, Olaf sent me a couple of drawings. We'd been doing some work in a couple of shows that he'd had in Metro Pictures in New York, where a lot of words or more conversations had started to come into the work and the groups had started to disappear. So there's this kind of real fractured kind of dialogue going on between sculptures or between just things. And sometimes the words that are coming out don't actually make sense. The kind of open-ended questions which kind of I thought could work, because it could, you're inviting an audience in to interpret it, and that's all you can do when you come across a piece of, if you come across a bench, you can sit on it, if you come across a piece of art, you look at it. But if there's a question, there's a direct involvement, it's kind of taking you on. It's almost kind of a confrontation. So we kind of did a couple of, during the summer last, or late in the summer last year, we did, the park has regular kind of events, community events, and we mocked up a couple of the sculptures and invited people to stick on words, and you know, we invited people to do their suggestions, what they'd want to see on it. Right? But I mean, without being rude, basically they were rubbish. And I don't say that out of kind of any kind of animosity, but the you're just getting texts and of kind of in text speak. And whilst that would have worked maybe on a smaller scale, how would that kind of transcribe in about 25 years? So we kind of had to make a decision that Olaf was going to pick one of these things or make it very different, or we would just say, well, we're going to do our own and we'll ask the questions of the community. By chance, someone within St. Paul's did, as Olaf was leaving, quite a strange thing to come out with when you're talking to an artist or you're consulting with an artist. You just say, well, it better be good, because it's a permanent work, it better be good. So I thought that was quite an odd thing to say, but we kind of talked about that, kept throwing that back in. So Olaf, we've done these site visits, and basically Olaf was talking, getting these produced, and as far as Olaf knew and as far as I knew, we were dealing with someone producing these. Olaf had worked with before, making these in Portugal. They're solid marble, by the way, but and kind of carved. You can see some of their previous work in the background. And so we'd sent the sketches and they were making these up. In the meantime, some of the site visits, Olaf, we did it, his planes were so delayed, so ridiculous, and the story of how he got here is just ridiculous. To the point where he'd arrived at midnight one day, we did a site visit at St. Paul's at 6 a.m. and Olaf's back on a flight to New York at like 10 a.m. and that happened a couple of times, and it's just a miracle that he got back here again, but obviously volcanoes pending, see if we can get back out again. And then the day that they were meant to be installed, the day they were meant to arrive in Bristol, we got a call saying that they weren't in Portugal, they're in China, which is kind of a bit of a difference. So there's kind of toing and froing, but that all kind of added into like the little story that was going on, a little narrative that we're kind of building. And these kind of these stories kind of stuck, and they kind of surround what are two roughly about 5.5-6 foot sculptures. And hopefully the sculptures can start to ask, or those stories will keep bleeding out in ever widening circles. Going back to the person who'd said, it better be good, we actually used it because it was such a good question. I mean, if something's going to be there for 25 years, you're going to spend public money on it, it better be good. So we used that, and then the reply to that kind of question or statement is, one day it will, one day it will, which you can take that as quite a negative, or you can take that as quite a positive for an area in Bristol and all the regeneration or the people within St. Paul's. I sometimes look at it, I've been back to the park 2-3 times now, and sometimes I read it and I think, oh, that's quite a negative statement to put on some permanent sculpture, but sometimes I read it again, I think it's quite uplifting. It's like that people would pull together and one day it will be better. And obviously with the election tomorrow, I think it's quite timely. For those that haven't been to the park, you can see some of the regeneration in the background. It's got skateboards, obviously it's got your basketball. And you can see on the front that these letters are not just stuck on, they're carved in there. And one of the stories that somebody from the stakeholders group had said that he wanted sculptures that deterred prostitutes, which I thought was strange thing to add to the brief. And I can basically, if you can imagine, but towards the trees at the back, they were going to be placed there, but we decided on here. But he said that people always come into the park, and in the corners of the park it's quite rife, and he said if you saw these figures there in the dark, you probably wouldn't approach that thing. So it's pushing it out of one area, possibly pushing it into another, but maybe into somewhere that's more manageable. But he did question, once we'd commissioned them, once we did put them in the ground, he said, does it deter prostitutes? And I was like, I don't know, go have a look. So you can see there is kind of, even though it's in that kind of Olaf's kind of quite hand-drawn signature style, there is obviously the craft of making these by the stonemasons. It's really nicely done. The front is slightly polished, the back is rough. There you can see the kind of thickness of the letters. Obviously that was probably 2 days and people started climbing on them. Ollie probably won't thank me because we did try and design them that weren't that climbable, but kids will be kids. And again, these kind of like these bright white marble figures kind of act as deterrent to prostitutes, or they're kind of almost like headstones for what has been there before, or something quite, almost can be taken as quite traditional municipal sculpture, really, in terms of that they exist in a similar way as that we would see something on a high street, but in terms of being in the park, but they are quite light-hearted, so you've got the kind of family element to it. But basically, the placing of the sculptures was so you could see them from every entrance point. So the act of curiosity and actually going and looking was the most important thing. E.T. again, but this kind of, the second part of the commission, obviously we were aware of all that photographic work and his films, one of which you can see tonight. This is from Home One, I believe. So we're looking for like an added extra, what else could we get for the park? So the commission just wasn't in the park. The commission for St. Paul's Park just didn't keep in St. Paul's. What could we do that would take it out of St. Paul's, where it might be seen in different places? So kind of looking at all those films, some of his other photographs, which were kind of more, use different people and different effects. And we were looking at kind of doing a fireworks display or some kind of event-based piece. In the end, despite a few ups and downs with health and safety, and we were going to release 400 balloons, but apparently the cows of Somerset have got really strong kind of input into Bristol City Council, and we weren't allowed to release the balloons because they die. But I quite like the idea of the balloons when Olaf came, because it carries on some of his other colour studies that he's done. The idea that the people of these would not directly represent the kind of St. Paul's, but when they were released, that they would, they would go far and wide, but we weren't allowed to do that. So on a very horrible day last year, a very nice bunch of volunteers came, and we kind of did various shots, weather permitting, and we couldn't release the balloons, so we kind of, instead of taking not letting the balloons go, we basically decided that the people almost would be hidden. So that kind of, it does almost represent people. But it's almost a celebration of the park. It's slightly doctored, but there's about 40, 50 people, 400 balloons, and the balloons were taken away. And you can kind of take that for what you want, but basically I knew that this photograph now is going to be in Bristol City Museum, which is very nice, hopefully. We've done a series of limited editions which are going to the volunteers, which is good, but obviously through Olaf's other work, that image of St. Paul's now distributed around the world. And in terms of kind of community involvement, it was quite light-handed. There's a light touch to it, they're involved, but the artist drove the commission, and the council kind of was, the council were fantastic in that they weren't heavy-handed in what they were doing. It was kind of like they let me kind of make decisions or kind of push decisions. And again, obviously Olaf, came up with two fantastic pieces of work. That's kind of roughly what I'm saying. I just want to say one little thing. Sadly, Emily, who's in this photograph, she came to one of our volunteers, and said she passed away before the sculptures were put into the ground, before the photograph came out. So I just wanted to mention that tonight. I guess that's the point where you say that art doesn't really matter when it comes down to things like that, but I think maybe take it on the other way, that art does actually matter, because it has that curiosity. and that, you know, people like Emily or other people, people in St. Paul's, they're not being told what to do, they're not being told what to see or what to look at. These things are there, we've talked to them about it, and with the balloons, that idea of that, you know, it's that you can just spread, and it can, these things can just subtly get into everyday life, like TV, like films, like all the things that Olaf maybe takes his influence from. Maybe all the things that we kind of, maybe things we ignore, things we don't take, or we take for granted, but, so I'm going to leave it there, and we're going to let Adam and Olaf discuss perhaps a different part of his practice. Thank you.
Right. Well, these things are always a little bit embarrassing, really, talking to somebody in this. The British comedy has taken the piss out of this kind of setup so many times. So we'll try and do this seriously, but Olaf's not somebody that really likes to talk very much about his work, so there might be quite long questions and rather short answers. So
he knows me well.
So we'll start off, Mr. Brownrigg.
Bruining,
sorry, yeah. That's a joke, Olaf.
Okay. Good.
It's a new kind of joke.
Oh, well, I don't get it.
Yeah. And comedy obviously plays a big role in a lot of your work, and certainly it's what attracted me to your work when I first saw it. It is actually a very rare occurrence of laugh out loud art. And I know that you won't want to talk about the comedy, but try, Olaf.
Well, I have to say, I mean, my art in general, I try as an artist. It's a very fine line. You cannot, you're not a comedian, you know. I mean, I don't want to make art where it's just like a laughing when you see it. So I try always to make art where there's a lot of humor, you can laugh, but you also you can go a step further and think about more things. Not that I'm a dogmatic person or someone who wanna really teach something, but comedy in general I like very much.
And a lot of your work draws from comedy in many ways. I mean, lots of your influences.
Well, I would say, I mean, when I would describe my work myself, it is already kind of stupid, but I'm a big Woody Allen fan. Woody Allen for me represents, for example, a guy who makes movies, but kind of have a lot of humor, but also the tragedy of life is there too.
So yeah, I mean, it's quite British humor in many ways, isn't it?
I would say so. I mean, I like British humor in general, yeah.
Humor with an edge. I mean, there's plenty of, I think, comedy that really sits more comfortably in the sphere of art in many ways that comes out of Britain. And I think that's probably part of the connection. I mean, certainly I am not suggesting that you're slapstick.
I mean, I wish I would. I mean, yeah, when I could do it, I would probably do it. I'm a big fan of Buster Keaton, for example. Is that slapstick?
Yeah.
So I wish I actually tried to do a movie called The Apple, where it would be black and white, and people would play in a way like Buster Keaton would play. But something like that is just, that happened 90 years ago, and you can just not redo it. It's just genius how it is.
And a lot of those influences, a lot of your influences are from America. That seems to be quite, I mean, you're Swiss.
I'm Swiss, but I live
the home of comedy as we know it.
Right, yeah, tragic comedy there. No, but I live since 10 years in New York. I mean,
and you're from a small village in Switzerland.
I grew up there.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
And you wanted to leave.
Well, when you want to see dramatic like that, yes. But actually, the last 10 years, or like 5 years before I moved to New York, I was based in Zurich. And Zurich is the biggest town in Switzerland, so still small. American influences, what can I say to that? I mean, I think I was always a big fan of Hollywood. And I was always alone, because when you're an art student, and I also, I mean, sure, I watched all the Fassbinder movies, I've been like, you know, would, like, till I was, when I was like 22, I had like short hair and round golden glasses, and I would only read philosophy books, and I would say fuck Hollywood and like it's bad, whatever. All of a sudden I started to kind of like it, maybe the power of the language. It's not that Hollywood would be really smart. The stories that the films tell mostly are kind of stupid, but just how they are told are so perfect, so visually. And I'm a kind of a visual junkie, so I like visual things very much, so I think it's very strong.
This is quite a curious kind of turnabout from earnest radical to mainstream media junkie.
Yeah, what could that be? I didn't drink alcohol till I was 25. Maybe that's the reason.
Is that the point of turn?
No, I don't know. It's just, you know, as an artist, one thing I was always interested in, I'm always curious about life, and I want to discover things I don't know. And that was maybe a reason I just want to know what it is. Now I know what it is, and...
Are you ready to go back to Fassbinder?
Maybe. Really, no joke. Yeah, maybe.
Okay, so I was also kind of interested in people. I'm quite interested in people that come from rural places and from small places, Grisdale's in the middle of nowhere, my own background's similar, and I think there's often people that are quite driven when they come from somewhere that perhaps they feel is inferior in the world stage. Is that, am I gonna draw you out on that one?
Not at all, I mean,
Switzerland's not
it's not that I grew up with a cow, you know, like it's not like that I had like the cow was my best friend, but sure, Switzerland is a small country. It's a very special country, Switzerland. When you grow up in Switzerland, you just grow up in the country club of the planet. I think it's a very special place. It's a place where it's so special that it's quite unrealistic to grow up there. We don't have any major problems. We are rich. We have like the highest suicide rate.
That's what you claim.
Huh?
So yeah. You claim. Swiss are always saying that, highest suicide
I know,
rate in the world. Who counts?
I don't know who counts. You're right, who counts? Maybe it's just a saying, but definitely Swiss people, they have a lot of time to think about themselves and like do...
Existential things.
Existential things, yeah.
And was your father not a Hell's Angel?
I wish.
Oh.
No, he had a Harley Davidson, but...
Well, Swiss Hell's Angel. Actually, there was a very extreme sect of Swiss Hell's Angels, isn't there?
I think so.
In the 60s.
Yeah.
So, again, a sort of being enamored of American culture. But your own kind of take on it from what you're saying is within a context of European intellectual position in terms of how you look at American culture. And that's still quite evident, I think, in a lot of your work.
I don't like to look at that American culture. I don't like to look at any culture. I like actually look as a universal kind of perspective. I try always to define the human, and sure the human has different colors. I mean, if you live in Papua New Guinea or if in the United States or in Switzerland, but what I lately in my work mostly speak about is like kind of the things where it seems to stay since the 200,000 years, or how long human beings in that form exist, always the same. I mean, there is sexuality, there is food, there is greediness, there is power. You want to have power, all these things. That's what I'm interested in more. And it's true, I mean, my first work, when you saw like the images with the casket and the sex doll, I've been also, in the beginning, very influenced of horror movies and stuff like that. But the last, like, I would say 5 or 4 years, I'm more interested in what is it really what human beings carry over generations, you know, what is it what makes me nervous speaking in front of people, what is it what, you know, very, very, how can you call it, universal things,
yeah?
Yeah.
Cool things.
Cool things.
Cool. So just, yeah, talk a bit about your way you use the web, because you're saying they're kind of universal, and I mean, I'm conscious that a lot of your work is actually, it's a nice habit.
Well, sorry. Sorry, I have to see that.
I thought it was a bit odd starting to chew gum just before the talk.
But it gets too chewy. Okay, continue, so Adam.
You research a lot of your work on the web, and then you actually set things up through the web, which is quite an interesting process to go through. Presumably the reason those sculptures were produced in China was that you contacted that company through the web and probably didn't know very much about them. That seems to be quite...
No, okay, I have to say, the reason that they've been produced in China was like just a human-to-human experience. As a friend of mine who produces stuff for me, and he just didn't brief me, he didn't inform me. Well, that had nothing to do with the web. The web in general, I mean, the web in general is, I mean, that's one of the things I'm very interested in, because that's what changes cultures at the moment. We are in a very, very interesting turning point socially, and that is because the web.
In many ways, another aspect of your work is the kind of combination of the blindingly obvious with the extremely obscure, and the kind of collision of those two things. And quite often you get that's something that happens on the web all the time. You look for something, you know, well known, and you find something very strange in relation to it.
Yeah.
And so that kind of mode of thinking is reflected a lot, in your work.
Right. No, but that's, Adam, you know my work quite a long time, and I think as an artist I also changed, and I think the last few years I go away a little bit from that moment that I want to just first shock someone or be like a kind of, you know, go over the border a bit, because you're right, I mean, you can open web pages, blogs and whatever, and you see like one, and now it's Photoshop. I mean, it's incredible. Remember 10 years ago, you saw like Ines from Lamsberg, and she was the first who would make incredible nice Photoshop works, and you would see photographs in a gallery and you would think like, wow, is that possible? That's like a child body with an adult face lying there, and you would stand there and think like, wow, that was the same time like Matrix came out and all these things. Today, I mean, you go to the internet, you see like advertising, whatever it's all about, you see like rabbits talking, you see babies talking, you see, I mean, these times are over. Mm-hmm. And that's why more for me in future I will focus on big things, like things we just care.
Big
themes.
Big themes.
Big themes.
Right.
Big things. Big themes. Yeah. So I cannot. And also, by the way, as an artist, I mean, I work since 10 years now as a professional artist, and you have to change. You cannot stay the same. That kills you.
Yeah, and you're very conscious of your how you operate within the art world, and so you're somebody possibly outside of London. That's quite an unusual way for artists to think of themselves within the commercial sector. And you, I know, you're very a great devotee of the Artfacts.
Artfacts. No, it is. What can I say? I could try to be Mother Teresa and be like completely without. But sure, the art world is very hard. When I would just work for myself, and I would work in my studio, I would close the door, or let's say I would write a diary and close it in the night and put it under my pillow, I would be the happiest person. But no, I have to pay my rent. I have to maintain my assistance. I have to on things, and so I have to work in a commercial. I have to make money. And I have to be, like a lot of other artists, aware about it. And the Artfacts is just, I don't know if you guys know that, that's this webpage, and they rank artists from 1 to like 120,000. And I followed that page since maybe 10 years, and I just think it's funny. I'm not addicted to it at all. Well, I mean, I check each week once or something.
Yeah, only once a week. I think it's a very useful thing in itself. I often refer to it when I'm annoyed. So, what else have I thought about asking you about? Yeah, I mean, I think that kind of, again, the way you work, and to me, that again represents these kind of polar opposites. So you're kind of very embedded in the mainstream art world, art circuit, and at the same time, you're kind of outside of it, and you kind of don't really take part. You don't know very much about contemporary art.
You underestimate myself.
Oh, you've learned.
Sure, I mean, I'm always around art. I mean, I have non-stop people around me working in art, like all my friends are artists, most of them. So if I would have to be blind or deaf, I mean, I get...
You're not that interested in it, though.
I'm not that interested in it. I'm honestly not that interested in art, yeah. I mean, I love to work as an artist. I like the people working in that field. I like to have shows in galleries and museums and stuff like that, but art in itself, it's just not that interesting. And it's out of that reason not interesting, because artists, they try just to make themselves an easy life often. They go in stereotypic art patterns, they make like on and on the same shit again and again. So I go to see shows, and when I see shows, I say, oh yeah, I saw that before, like someone did just something with someone, and now even more. I mean, it's a time of references, it's a time where we dig out all the pieces from the minimal art in like the 60s or 70s and redo it. Mm. Like in fashion or like in music, that seems. But what I want to say, compared with fashion and music, I mean, fashion and music, they have to kind of give you, fashion has to give you clothes to wear, music has to entertain you in a way, but art should be really the possibility and the window to open up to the world and speak about it. And I often miss that. I miss it in contemporary art, because there's an art market, because there are collectors who want to spend money to buy a painting because that's what they kind of hang up on the sofa. So the art market itself, it's a very traditional and a very conservative place. And I'm always very happy when I find myself outside of it. So I came now from Switzerland for a museum show. The show is in a big museum in Switzerland, but also I was a part of a comic festival. Not that I would really be a comic artist at all, but I was very proud about it. And I always like when I feel as an artist, I really can care about what each normal person thinks, and not like produce something what is just like understandable when you have the backpack of art history on your back and say like, oh, you have to be a smart, educated art person to understand it.
Yeah, I mean,
so that's my, but so it sounds a little bit too hard. So
that sounds good. I would agree with you, but I just don't do the other bit that you do.
The what?
The art bit, where you do deal with the world of art and succeed in it. I mean, it's quite, coming back to this kind of the polarities thing that I see so much, that I see in your work. You probably don't see it.
The polarity, I'm not sure. No, I mean, yeah.
Underneath it, there's this Swiss boy with gold-rimmed glasses. Activist.
No, not activist at all. But as an artist, you have a chance. You have no boss in your neck in the morning who tells you what to do. You can wake up and do what you want. And I'm just curious that a lot of artists don't take advantage of that. That they just do again something what kind of we know already. You know, they don't surprise anymore.
Yeah,
it's finished.
But there's a risk in changing, isn't there?
It's a risk. I mean, sure, it's a risk. Yeah, it's always a risk.
See your graph going down.
Yes, but the best artworks in my past been always the ones where I didn't know if they fail or if they succeed. All the other artworks I do and I think, oh, they're safe. They're probably boring, you know. And I did a lot of boring works too.
Mm. No, it's nice. Mostly, no, you haven't. You know. Would you like to say which of your works?
That cat painting was that.
That was a seminal changing moment for you.
No, that was just, I mean, 2003, you know, like the painting was big and like all people went crazy for paintings and all the people around me said to me, oh, make a painting. I said, I cannot paint. Why would I make paintings? So I hired that young student in Vienna, a talented man, and he painted it for me.
On the internet?
I was there, but it's a soulless piece. I mean, a painting, you have to paint yourself. You cannot, I mean, Damien Hirst.
What about highlights, though? What about these key, can you?
Key works, I have to really say, for example, the Easter Island work Gordon showed, that was just a risky thing. I went with these sticks and these shapes I cut up in New York, to Easter Island, traveled like for 24 hours, no idea what will come out. It was a great piece. Or
I mean, that's quite, I think the backstory on the on Easter Island is very funny as well. That a story you told me once about being in the bar. You'd had a war with this too long, maybe.
Yeah, no, it's like before I went there, I contacted a travel agency on the island and I said, I want to come and make the project. And the woman there was writing me back, oh, don't come to Easter Island. We don't need you here, because that was, you know, like that's that kind of holy monuments. And so I just ignored her and went there. And then a few days later, I would be on Easter Island with my friend Brian, having dinner in a restaurant. And there was this woman next to us, and we started to speak with her. And it was exactly that woman. Mm-hmm. So incredible. And then I made a joke, because I had maybe one glass of wine, and said like, oh yeah, now here I am, blah, blah, we did it. And she just stood up and walked away. That was good.
Yeah, and but I mean also that there was a sort of, I mean it's a bizarre thing, Easter Island, there's a sort of belief system around, that's built up around what these heads are, what they represent, and that, I mean it's a big tourist destination.
It's big. Whenever you have a chance to go to Easter Island, do it. It's the magical place. It's sound like a travel
agent. Because of the trashy tourism, or because of the
No. That's the thing. It's not trashy. There's only two planes a week coming in, and they have for example the hotels. They're very low key, so they try to really keep it as a kind of a ecotourism. You don't see like jeeps, like kind of like, you know, beer drinking people, and it's really a culture trip when you go there. But it's one of the most remote islands. And it's just when you're there, you feel you're surrounded of water, like for 1,000 miles, you know, around it. That's really magical. Yeah. And also the fact, I mean, I don't want to get too long now here, but the fact that Easter Island represents the failure of humans, so they would have maybe 600 years ago, they would colonize it with boats. They came on the island, and the island was like, had a big vegetation, like trees, jungle, beautiful. So the people go there, they would reproduce, get more and more people. They would start to make these statues. They would sizzle it out of the stone, and in order to transport them, they had to cut off the trees, like to roll these big monuments to the place where they want to set them up. And so they nearly took all the trees off. They started to have fights from the kind of two or three villages they have on there. Cannibalism started to take place maybe 300 years ago. Like 200 years ago, in the Spanish, I think, found the island. It was a destroyed island, people being like zombies on that island. And it was a beautiful place, and just the human came.
And then you turned up.
And I turned up, and I saved the whole island. No, it's a paradise.
I thought you were going to say that the tourism end of it was the magical bit, the exquisite level of service in the hotels.
I know.
You're
not
quite fond of that.
That's been quite not really.
So, Cannibal Tours, the film that we're about to show, Home 2. Have you ever seen Cannibal Tours?
I don't think so.
It's quite bizarre. You must see it sometime. I can't remember who made it now. Have people heard of it? Nobody knows it. It's okay. You're all right.
Well,
it's a very interesting, in relation to the documentary, which follows the exact route of the film that you made, and meets more or less the same people. It's an extraordinary thing to see in conjunction with Olaf's film. So
I have to definitely see.
Check it out after that. I think it's all, you'll find it online.
Okay, I write on it. So are you ready to see a movie? It will be a half an hour, is that okay?
Yeah. And then there'll be time for questions, a few questions afterwards. You want to do questions afterwards?
When you have questions, sure, yeah, that would be no problem. Before we show it, do I have to say something? One funny story I want to tell before I see the movie is the main actress is my best friend in New York, Brian Kerstetter, and we shot, this one is called Home 2, we shot Home 1 2 years ago. 5 years ago, and I told him I want to have a professional actor for these movies, and we went out like we always do in New York, and we've been probably by a bar, and he would say to me, oh, I can do it. And I watched at him and said, what did he ever played? I mean, why would he say something like that? Are you an actor? He said, no, I'm like a writer for, you know, he's a writer, not an actor. And so he started to act, and I really, really like his performance, and I will start to shoot next week in New York, the new movie with him, so he's my all-time actor, I guess.
And is Home 1 and Home 2, are they important works?
I would say they're very important works for myself, yeah. That's like, even you see the Home 2, I think that's really an important work. I think I reached this at work many levels of strangeness, many levels of political statements, of a lot of things are together, but you will see it, I mean.
Yeah, in case I never said it, it's amazing.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm sure I never had said that. Anyway.
Okay, then,
okay, so we'll put the film on now.
Yeah.
And it's about 28,
it's
half an hour.
Exactly 30 minutes.
And then we'll have time for questions afterwards. Should
we
take a sit here and stare at the audience while I watch?
I've got 2 hours. I'm gonna jog for a while. This is a nice place to jog. The main street.
See, now that is what a man looks like in Papua New Guinea. Okay?
Thank you.
You see how nice? That's what I was talking about. See, sometimes you can't really tell, you know, if it's a man or a woman.
See here? Here's a prime example. He looks like a man. This is a man.
Right. We're gonna fly up over those mountains there into the middle of the jungle onto our boat.
Well, yeah, I don't know who the pilot is. I think the pilot is the one that's filling up the tank, so it's actually the pilot is the gas attendant and the pilot, which is a little unconventional for me, but I would be willing to still get in the plane. So we're just gonna have to see. Maybe the pilot's here and do everything.
I think this is the moment of no return. Do I go back onto the plane?
The Australian woman, she fell into the gully. She fell right off the bridge.
don't want to hold you a long time, really, when you want to go home, I understand. So.
Does anybody have any questions about either the Bristol project or last work in general, or perhaps about the film? Yep.
Let's go.
I do, yeah, but you know, not really in the detail. I will write a story, and especially when I travel, I have to plan the whole trip, so I have to write a little bit. For the new movie I do in New York, I have only a main story in my head, and we just improvise a lot. But the good thing is, since I work as a small crew, I don't need, you only need really a script when you have like 20, 30 people around, and you have to. But in my case, it's very nice to work like that.
Yeah.
Can I just ask you what you think the artwork you're working is about?
Yeah.
What do you think?
See, the art, yeah. They say the good thing is, I mean, people in general, they say positive things about it because they can understand it. The art world is also luckily kind of a big world, even if it's small, but there are different people in that art world. And sure, I'm probably surrounded of people liking this kind of works, like people with a kind of humor. I definitely don't have a gallery who would like have only like some very serious artists, like serious painters or whatever. So I'm surrounded with people. For example, Adam, he invited me a few times to do something in Grisdale. That's also, he's a funny guy. Not really. No, but he has a good kind of humor. I mean, he's definitely different than like some other curators I know. But I really don't care in future. Even less. I really want to make very public art. I want to more approach a lot of people away from the art world, without leaving the art world. That means I want to expand the art world. Sounds not very like arrogant, but I think when I work the next 10, 20 years like that, and you will see my body of work I did, I'm quite happy to maybe see that I went over borders, you know, that I went on the over the usual context, and so long I can do it, I'm happy.
I asked that question because I think so many students now feel that they have to, and this is directed perhaps to students, feel that they have to have a very clear idea about what their work is about, and a very polished idea. So for instance, when they leave college, they feel that perhaps they have to have a very specific thing. They're very knowing, more so than, for instance, when I was at college.
Yeah.
More of an understanding of the commercial art world. So I was very interested in what you said about that. And what number are you on the art list?
This week, I don't know. This week, honestly, I didn't check, but I'm always around 350 or something.
It's 357 this morning.
Okay, 357.
Going down.
Yeah, quite.
It was 160 at one time,
though. No, never 160. No. No, I'm still not. Anyway, no. Let's forget that list. But
there's not a lot of analysis of your work in a way. I mean, a lot of the books you've done don't open it up for analysis, and I think a lot of your galleries are not particularly interested in analysing what it's about.
Well, but
it doesn't really matter.
It doesn't matter.
There's a lot of seductive images. There's a lot of collisions of things happening. It's very easy to read and interpret things into it.
Right, I think. A lot of art, I mean, you cannot explain what it really says, and in my case, that is for me a successful art piece when I cannot really explain it. So when I do something and I have people seeing different stories in it, I would see, I think that's a very nice thing.
But interesting with the new work, with the sculptures, which kind of stem from the drawings, which do appear to be saying, that they appear to be trying to be very explicit.
Not at all. No. Gordon, can you switch? Maybe you're here, okay. Not at all, they're not at all explicit. I can show you very quick.
Are they saying something? I mean, it's not, they're words on there. You can't miss them, you can't not understand the words.
Yeah, but here you see, like, that was a show I did in Metro Pictures last year. There's, for example, that drawing, Idiots. That's like a group of people standing there with their mobile phones. So, sure, I mean, it's a very simple drawing, but you could start to think about from that point on. So I wanna think about very simple things, and I think, or for example, the no-yes person down here. So it's like the conflict between intellect and body, or like this thing. That's only a starting point to have an avalanche of ideas about it. And some people can watch at that figure no-yes and say, ha, 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 funny, walk away. Someone could write a book about it. So the big questions about life, they are simple, and you can react to them differently. You can write a philosophic book, or you can make a simple drawing. But I see it as really a starting point of things, and this show was about the big questions in life, questions you would ask when you're a teenager. And I'm now 40, so I'm in the half of my life. I thought I have to dedicate work to these questions. So you watch it and you start to go on. So hopefully, but not.
Question in the middle.
Similarities between my work and other people's work. There are some people I understand the work very well. So I see other artists and I would understand what they want to say and I appreciate it. But my work is quite, I try to, well, that's a good question, because this 2 days ago I met the guy called
David Shrigley.
Not David Shrigley, he's a Russian guy who called Dan Prochovsky or something like that. He's very famous to make these black and white wall drawings. And since I make black and white wall drawings, and I knew that I didn't invent it, you know, I'm not the first who's doing that. So I met that guy, and it was actually quite pleasant to speak with him about it. We started to speak about the different pens we use. It was very nice. So that is nice, but in general, I'm not really someone who watches art. I don't care about it. I do it really, it's like to write a diary. It's like to make my own statement, tell a story about this life. Sure, I studied art. I'm in that world. I know about where my tools are. But I'm not, how I said, I'm really, I watch a lot of movies. I listen to music. I try to be a normal human being, kind of like the Joe Average, to like just understand the world, not because I want to analyze it and redo it as an artist. It's just I don't know, I'm just not so into art, I guess.
There's a question up there.
I would be happy also. And I see people can call me whatever they want. I'm always happy, really, and it's not, it doesn't, a lot of things I say now sound a little bit arrogant, and I don't mean it really like that. And I would be happy. That's the thing, when I produce something, I'm just happy when someone finds something in it, whatever it is, you know. Sure, when someone would say, okay, you're like a Nazi, I would maybe say, okay, that's maybe a little bit too political, or, you know. But I mean, a lot of my works, yeah.
But I mean, that's what interests me about your work, that it's political, that it, you know, that it is saying things, that it is quite, it's quite confrontational. That's, it's not just a happy, I'm happy if somebody interprets it that way. It's in there.
It's definitely in there. But you know, my work, and that's the beauty for myself in my work, it changes and changes, it gets more and more, it's like you cannot really, what can you say to that? Is that political? Is that just, that's just beautiful, and it's like kind of makes references to art history, maybe not. So
I
just...
Too long in New York.
Huh?
Too long in New York.
Too long in New York, maybe,
that's
like all
beautiful.
The...
It's hot.
No, but I just want to say, like, I want to, my big dream is like in 20 years to have somewhere a big retrospective and just, you see that thing, you cannot really say what it is, but maybe you feel a line through it, and that would be kind of my person. When I die one day, I want to look back at least at my work and say, oh right, I experienced life kind of in really different colors, you know. I would be frustrated when I see, oh, I made only like some concrete shapes. I don't want to have names, but like a lot of artists, they do one thing and they do it the whole life. So I try to make a lot of different things, more.
I think we'll probably try and end it there.
Yeah.
But just, I mean, in terms of where I kind of always looked at it, it's kind of in terms of a real nice possibility of doing things and of thinking things, and of maybe of going places and doing things and thinking things in a different way. It's all just about possibility. Been quite lucky that you get to do that, but obviously everybody thought like that, I mean, it'd be crazy if everybody was an artist, because it'd just be a terrible world.
Yeah.
But so I'd just like to thank Helen and the Arnold Freeney, and also Aldo and Ollie from Bristol City Council and their support, and for Adam Sutherland for coming, and also for yourself for paying for the tickets to come in this evening, but also to Olaf for the work that he's done here in Bristol and for coming to speak to us tonight. Thank you.